and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. I've never had him on the show before, but his name is Stephen Dobbins. He's a very famous fiction writer, and his new book is called Burn Palace, a novel that has been thoroughly okayed by Stephen King and just thoroughly gushed about by Stephen King, actually. Hello.
How are you? Good.
It's good to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Lucky you that Stephen King likes your book.
Well, I was glad. Certainly, he's a very generous man. I felt fortunate.
How did that come about? That he got his hands on a copy?
It simply was my agent sent something to his agent, who sent it to him.
There's a whole blurb on the back of the book just explaining how much he really loves the book, and that made me want to read it right away.
I was very glad about that. I mean, we used to have, a long time ago, we had the same editor, so we knew each other. We'd met, but other than knowing each other, no.
Sometimes I feel like everybody in publishing is connected somehow in the past or the present. It seems like everybody knows everybody else. It's a very, it's like a big club.
Yeah, that seems that way sometimes. I'm not often down in New York, so I don't happen to run into it, but I know what you mean.
You wrote a book, and I think this was it 80s? I'm not sure, I forget the year that it came out, The Church of Dead Girls. It isn't as long as I thought. Was it in the 90s?
Yeah, 97.
97. That just completely blew me away. Absolutely blew me away. When I first read it, it was one of the most thrilling books I've ever read. I mean, it was just fantastic.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you felt that way.
And that's why we're talking now, because I was so thrilled with that book, and I thought, and when I saw you had a new book coming out, and it's been a while since you've had a new book.
A novel, yeah.
Yeah, you've been writing a lot of other things.
Right.
So what makes you decide what you're going to write next? Is it just whatever you want to?
It's pretty much that, or I'll think of, I'll have a new idea for something that'll get me going. So the Burn Palace was a way of discovering a way to tell the story, discovering a tone,
right,
and thinking how I could use both comic and serious and horrible things together.
It is. It's really a mixture of a lot of things, and that's what makes it so unusual. I mean, it's one of the most unusual books I've ever read.
Huh.
And it is. Does that surprise you to hear me say that?
I guess, having read the damn thing 25 times, it's hard for me to understand it. But if I think about it intellectually, certainly, in that it tries to go in so many directions in terms of mood and the number of characters and to show the town. Although Church of Dead Girls certainly are showing a different kind of town.
Absolutely. It's a totally different book, but, I mean, it's just a spectacular book. I mean, writers, to me, every once in a while they just write something that really goes through the roof and just really hits home, and that one for me did it, that Church of Dead Girls. Not that I didn't enjoy Burn Palace, I enjoyed that in a different way. It was different than I thought it was going to be. I mean, even when I knew that it started out with a baby disappearing and a snake being placed in its place. I mean, that to me, that's such a great beginning to a novel. I mean, how much more interesting can you get?
Yeah, I had that idea for some time, but I wasn't sure what to do with it. And then I found a place for it.
You certainly did. You're right, this book, when I think back on reading the book, I laugh. I just laugh at some of the characters, some of the situations. I mean, there are parts where the book's very over the top. Did you do that intentionally?
Unfortunately, you get to the point of thinking, well, what can I get away with? And so if it gets to be over the top in some way, probably I pushed it in that direction.
Right. But you seem to enjoy that. I mean, just by the way it's written, I can feel that you're enjoying telling an unusual story. That's what I feel.
That's very true. I had a good time writing that book.
Now, how long did it take you to write Burn Palace?
Oh, probably about 6 months.
6 months. So when you really get writing, you can really...
Then it becomes obsessive.
Does it?
Unless I get really stuck, but I'll work, a minimum of 6 hours a day.
Wow. That's a lot of time to spend on a book. Did you get stuck at all writing this book? I mean, were there any difficult parts to write?
Not really. I had a sense of the curve of the book. in terms of how I wanted it to be, and I had a number of scenes in my mind, or had written down. And each, you know, as I wrote a chapter, then things would occur to me that I would have to have in the next chapter or a chapter after that. And that seemed to sustain me pretty much to the end.
When you first start off the book, you said you had the idea about the snake, the child being kidnapped and the snake being replaced. Did you know that all those scenes in the book, or did they come to you as you were writing it?
A lot of them came to me. Some of them I knew. I mean, I thought at another time I had thought of having satanic masses out in the woods, out in the forest, and trying to connect that some way. And there are other things that I thought about or I'd taken notes about that I liked.
Yeah, satanic stuff, you know, sometimes it works really well and sometimes it doesn't to me. It works very very effectively in Burn Palace. I mean, everything's so... the characters are so, like Stephen King said, the character, you feel like you're watching this town from above. You're watching all these people. Some of them are so crazy, and some are, you know, some seem normal, but a lot of them seem abnormal. In fact, I think I'd say most of them seem abnormal.
But don't you think that, if you scratch a person, after a while you're going to find a real abnormal, not abnormal, but, you know, we all give each other our best faces, you know? And you get to know a person a little better, and they're not necessarily a bad person. They're just slightly different.
Exactly.
They're not always all roses and sugar.
And that's a point, and you make a good point. I mean, we're all unusual in our own way. We all have our little foibles and things. I mean, I love to eat corn every day, Monday to Friday. Now, that seems weird to me. When I think about it, I think, well, why do I like that? But I just enjoy it, and it's become a ritual to me. I don't know why, but some people would say that's really weird.
Yeah, I think that's their mistake. You know, I think that we all have something that's corresponding to that.
Right, and I guess I feel like I should think. I mean, for some reason, to let everybody know would bother me. And why should it? Why shouldn't I just be my own self and not care what other people think? I mean, why can't I live my life like that? I think that to myself. Are you like that at all?
Somewhat. I mean, it depends how much you want someone to interfere with your life. If you tell some friend that what you really like to do is to bite the heads off mice, and that you do it 3 or 4 times a week, you're going to get some strange looks.
Right.
But it's a perfectly harmless enterprise, I suppose.
I guess it's that fear that, you know, if people knew that about me, maybe they wouldn't like me as much. Maybe that's the fear that I have. And maybe that's a ridiculous fear. To some people, it would be. Like, who cares what they think about you? But
right.
I guess it matters in some way what people think about me, and maybe it shouldn't.
Well, it depends to what extent you're going to have that thinking go. If they're going to just think that you're mildly eccentric, you know, that's fine. If they're going to think you're a wacko, then you don't necessarily want that. But you're not a wacko. You're just slightly eccentric. You like you like that corn.
Do you have a background in psychology? You seem to be. I mean, all through the book, there's, you know, we're learning these things about people, the psychological things about the different characters. I mean, do you have some kind of background in that?
No, I've just read a lot and observed a lot, and I did a lot of journalism and. You know, who's the person that you're talking to at any time? You see a kind of pleasant appearance, but you can see things in body language and so on that indicates another kind of person. I don't mean a bad person or anything, but somebody who seems perfectly relaxed, but you realize after a moment it's not relaxed at all. It's actually very tense, and it's just pretending to be relaxed. You know, you can easily come upon someone like that Oh, there are lots and lots of things, really.
Now, there is a snake on the cover of the book, which is interesting. I mean, the snake is very central to the first part of the book. It's not really central to the whole book, but it does add a lot of interest, I mean, to the book. And it's amazing how much the town is saying, well, how many snakes were there? I love that part where they're trying to figure out how it's kind of gotten exaggerated as to how many snakes were really in the room at the time. So, I mean, and that's, I guess that adds to the comedic level of the book, too.
Well, I mean, I expect if I were in Nurse Spandex's shoes and pulled back that blanket and saw what basically is a 6-foot snake, you could easily imagine that there's more than one. and you're not going to hang around to check it out.
No, certainly not.
And she has a hysterical nature anyway.
Exactly. And they all, it's interesting because, I mean, there's a lot of characters in this book who are very, they seem to be very sensitive, very unusually sensitive people. Like, they care about what other people think about them. Like, it's just interesting, all these different characters. I love the characters. I mean, the characters almost have kind of can be a book unto themselves. They're so unusual. You know?
Well, I was just trying to make them thoroughly three-dimensional. I mean, they all, you know, some of them I had in mind before I started the book, but most of them just sort of showed up in the book. I mean, I thought that I need this kind of person at this point, for instance, that the snake has to belong to a boy, and I'm going to have to introduce that boy. And what kind of boy is he? And it comes, you know, I had Uncle Herschel who lived in Oklahoma, so I just took Herschel's name, and there are a couple of other little things that you take from other sources.
Do you always do that as a writer, to put something in that has something to do with your life, and even if it's a small way?
It can. I mean, something that I've seen, surely. I mean, something that has really struck me, or a habit that somebody has, or yeah, anything like that. I don't do a lot of that. Most of it's invented, but you know, I'm trying to go have a steady pace in the writing.
Right. Why don't you explain for people who don't know yet what Burn Palace is exactly about, so they have a little bit of an idea what the book's about. So I'm sure they're already interested in it, but I'd like to hear your take on the exact...
Well, it takes place in a small town on the Rhode Island coast. It's something that I've done in other books, and a lot of writers do this, certainly, is to give a place that appears safe and then introduce elements of stress which make the people think or realize that nothing is quite safe, and then to see how they react to that stimuli. In this case, it's the person who's not necessarily the hero, but who carries it through is a state police detective. So he's trying to figure out what's the cause of these things. Oh, there are other police too. And shortly after the snake is found in the baby's crib, there's a man found dead in a swamp who has been scalped. And people put those two things together, not for any rational reason, just because they're two extreme things. And so you think, well, they must be together in some way. And one thing sort of leads to another, and they find information that's coming about some activities in the woods or the swamp. And it's the character spread. The girl who had the baby didn't want the baby. She calls it the devil's baby. So there's a certain sense then of witch covens or satanic covens.
Rosemary's Baby, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So all those things get explored as people trying to figure out, you know, what's happened to our town.
A town that really didn't have a lot going on before this.
Well, except in summer when it's a beach town.
Right.
I mean, where I live is like that. And I imagine this town of Brewster being up the coast about 14 miles from here. I mean, I live, you know, Westerly has a population of about 20,000. In the summer, it has a population of 40,000.
Wow.
The beach is right at the edge of the town.
Right. Interesting. When you read a book like this and you read and The Church of Dead Girls, which I, oh my gosh, that book is wonderful. Are they going to re-release that in paperback sometime, or any form of publishing?
I would like them to. They haven't done it yet.
I mean, I tried to sell it to a friend of mine. We couldn't even get a copy of it. And I said, well, you know, I guess you have to go to a used bookstore or something, but I keep hoping they'll bring it out so I can tell her, yeah, it's available now. Because it's such an extraordinary book. I mean, I've never read anything like it, and I just remember the feeling when I read it of how good it really was. Just a great thriller.
I mean, it did better in England really than it did here, and it did extremely well in Holland. It certainly did well in the States, but there was a complaint that it was too slow at the beginning and so on. And that's sort of what I wanted. I mean, I wanted it to build up over a period of time or
a
period of ages.
Well, that's what Burn Palace is the same way. It's slow, and it's a little slow in the beginning and builds up as the book goes on.
Right, but I think it's less so because because I have that nice scalping and these other things.
That's true. That's certainly true. But, I mean, a good story has to unfold. A good story doesn't necessarily unfold all at the beginning.
Exactly.
I mean, it's got a... Now, did you teach writing, or are you teaching writing now?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I've taught in Master of Fine Arts programs at a lot of places, and I'm still involved with a college in North Carolina, Warren Wilson College, which has a graduate MFA program.
So you do teach writing. So you're.
But it's almost always poetry.
What is it about poetry that you like so much? I'm curious. I mean, I love poetry, and I just wonder what. Is poetry more fun than fiction, or are they both equally the same for you?
I think I can be more obsessive with a poem, and I think with a poem you can say something more precisely than you can in prose because you're using the form to communicate meaning as well as the language. And also you're much more dependent on metaphor within the poem. So you have different kinds of thought working together to make something, to try and define something. Whereas fiction, you don't have that same degree of metaphor, and the form basically doesn't exist unless you want to fiddle with the language in some way. I mean, I tried to make the language of this book change in numbers of different places. You know, it could be very straightforward, or it could seem to be an omniscient narrator talking about it, and, you know, various things. But with poetry, it's just I don't know. I'm just obsessed by it. But I do think that, I mean, everything we say is a diminishment of the idea that we just had. And so you try and think, how can I make this idea that I just had more translatable rather than just become sticks and stones? And poetry is a way of doing it. Unfortunately, not many people read poetry. But I think a lot of poets have brought that on themselves. I mean, poetry has to communicate to my mind, and that doesn't seem like such a bizarre notion.
Right.
But there are an awful lot of poets writing now who see accessibility as being a sin, as being a fault. Hmm. It boggles my mind. But in any case, it needs to communicate. You're trying to show something that moved you deeply, and you're trying to show it in such a way that it moves the reader deeply.
That's fascinating. I mean, is there any certain, like the time it takes you to write a poem, or is each poem different? I'm wondering about how hard it is to write a poem as opposed to fiction. I would think a novel would be much more difficult to write than a poem.
Well, the poem is short.
Yeah.
You know, but like, if it were comparable in size in some way, I'd be spending a lot more time on the poem than on the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't call a poem done for at least a year. And even in that year, you know, I mean, you're trying to develop or trying to maintain some degree of objectivity about it. And many times the only thing that can make you more objective is the passage of time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You come back and look at it a week later or a month later. That's true of fiction as well.
I wonder what makes, I mean, you look at some poem, I mean, the poem about trees that's so well known, and, you know, there's different poems that are extremely well known and then other poems that never get noticed. And I wonder what makes certain ones get noticed and not others. Are they just because they speak so much more than other ones, in your opinion?
Well, it depends on who's reading them. I mean, they're sentimental poems that have tremendous followings. And it's the people are moved by the sentiment of the poem. Most poetry, I mean, if it's of an equality, asks the reader to do some work at least, to try and figure out why this is being said or why am I being shown this, you know, and not work in the sense of being painful experience, but still just asking that question, why is this word here? Why does the poet start it in this way rather than some other way? What's this person trying to tell me? You're trying to figure out why the person wrote the poem. And you're trying to figure out the context.
Can we see what you're like by your poetry? I mean, if we read a whole book of your poetry, would we see, have an insight into what you're like? And what your life is like?
It would depend on the book. I mean, some of them you might. For instance, this last one, Winter's Journey, is more personal in that way than other books.
So you're like pouring your heart out in poetry. I mean, it's coming from the heart.
All of it. I mean, even if it seems to have nothing to do with me, still has to do with me. Mm-hmm. It's still a metaphor for some emotion or predicament that I find myself in. Even if it's, you know, about Mars, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. How old were you when you wrote your first poem? I'm curious.
Some point in high school, I guess.
In high school. That's it. I mean, you always hear about when men write letters, when men write poetry, how much it comes from the heart and how much more it means because men don't open up an awful lot. I mean, I try to be as open as I can. I'm an emotional person. I know that, so I love to open up to people. But you know, sometimes even I'm reticent to open up. I mean, are you the type that does open up a lot? I mean, are you that very outgoing?
No, not at all. I mean, if I'm pushed, I'll open up. I'm not going to lie about something. I might prevaricate in some way. But if someone's pushing me about how I'm feeling or what I think about something, it'll all come out.
Oh, okay. I'm wondering, did you have to go to college to write poetry? I mean, is it something that you've perfected by going to college, or can anybody write poetry in your mind?
Well, I think college gives you discipline, and it gives you a lot of shortcuts. And you don't have to go to college to get those things, but it makes it a lot harder. I mean, I didn't know what kind of books I should read when I was 17. I didn't know what poets were famous or that I might like. I was completely open. And so friends I had in college, you know, and classes I might take, but it would also be just other people in college who would just say, oh, you need to read so-and-so. And I'd read so-and-so and feel that I'd learned a great deal. So it's, you need college in order to learn how to think. And colleges are trying to take that away now, I think. But you think of the time when students had to learn Greek and Latin. It was not in order to speak Greek and Latin. It was in order to learn how to think, and learn how to think causally. That if this happens, then this happens, then this happens. To have a whole sense of cause and effect. And they don't do that in high school. And they don't do it. They don't do it in high school. So ideally, in college, and a very good college will do this, you're taught how to think. The first college I went to worked on the great books method. So you started with, you know, Aristotle and Plato and moved through a number of things, and then the same thing with literature, same thing with science and history. And you always read original texts. You didn't read textbooks. That was very exciting. I mean, to read Freud when I was 18 just really, really impressed me, and is one of the things that made me think about why people do what they do.
Well, yeah, and that's what I find fascinating about thrillers. I like to figure out why the person's doing it, why the serial killer's doing that, what's in his mind that makes him do that. And I'm very disappointed if the book doesn't explain that at the end, if I don't figure out exactly what is motivating this man. It's got to feel real to me. It can't feel like they made it up at the end, you know, like they just suddenly say, well, he just went off his rocker. He was just nuts and went crazy and started killing people. That doesn't make sense to me.
No, that's not very interesting at all. I mean, you want to know why the person did it, what led the person to do it. I mean, it's very easy to call the bad guy evil. He's not evil. I mean, he just has some serious problems. I mean, that poor kid who killed all those children. I mean, what kind of mess was he in his mind and his relationship with his mother and the rest of it? It's hard to dismiss that kid as being evil. It seems too easy to dismiss him for being evil, because whatever he has, we have it in us as well. We have that potential within us as well.
Right.
And
we're pushed it to the limit. I mean, there's no telling what could happen.
Exactly.
In the heat of the moment, that, you know, it's a scary thought. You think, you know, what could happen?
But we have to. I think we have to accept that. You know, we have a little Nazi inside of us. As we might have a little angel inside of us, and that we have to watch out for that Nazi, or you can use him for energy or aggressiveness or anything, but you don't want to have him lose his temper or just go wacko.
And so it's like a lot of people think because James Patterson writes about serial killers so much that he must be twisted inside, you know. He must have a twisted brain that would think up these plots, you know. And that's true of a lot of writers when I think about them. I think, well, what... I think of some of these writers, and I think, my gosh, how can they even think up this stuff? And what is it? I mean, if they spend a year writing a book like this, what goes through their minds as they're writing these books?
You live that book. I mean, some guy asked me, or somebody who'd read one of these Saratoga mysteries said, "You must be a nice guy because your detective is a nice guy." And I said, "You know, I'm all the characters in the book. I'm the bad guys, and I'm the good guys. All those." The characters in the book, and it's true of the Burnt Palace, have part of my own personality within them.
Is that true? Wow.
Sure, that's true of any writer.
I've never heard a writer quite explain it like that. That's very unusual. It's very interesting, too.
Well, they become, in a way, as metaphors. They're metaphors for some aspect of myself.
But, now, is the Saratoga series over? Are we going to see more of those?
I have another one that I'll probably finish and send out. I'm not sure if it's too much of an orphan at this point, but certainly I'll finish it and send it someplace.
Now this book, the new one, Burnt Palace, is from Blue Cider Press, which is a division of Penguin, I guess.
Blue Rider.
Oh, is it Blue Rider? Oh, you're right. It is Rider. I thought it said Cider first.
That's okay. There was an editor-publisher over at Simon & Schuster, David Rosenthal, who Simon & Schuster let go. And Penguin immediately hired him. David had been at Simon & Schuster for 18 years.
Wow, yeah, the name's familiar.
And so he went, Penguin hired him, and Penguin said, "We'll give you your own imprint." And that was Blue Rider. So...
And what year was that? I mean, how long has he been?
Not very long, 2 years ago.
Wow, and so you're one of the... Wow, that's great. It's funny, I've never heard of it before, but now that you say that it's new, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's in that sense, it's brand new. But he brought some editors over from Simon & Schuster, and he brought some writers over from there. So Penguin thought they were getting a deal. And this guy has tremendous experience, 18 years. That's a lot of time.
It's interesting the way publishers are, that suddenly, you know, that somebody who's been working there a long time is suddenly not there anymore. I mean, they're always moving around. I mean, there's a lot of, even the publicity for sure, but in other departments too, but it's suddenly they move on to another company. It's amazing the way that works.
They can be fired overnight. I mean, I've known that happen a number of times. Even it doesn't matter how high up you are in the chain. I had an editor at Penguin who was also the publisher of Penguin. She was British. And I had this book coming out, and they fired her in the middle of it. And she walked into her office the next day, and it was gone.
Wow, that's pretty scary.
And she's somebody who had years and years and years of experience in this. They thought she was too subtle or too quiet, or she was British.
Huh.
But that's how they did it. They just kicked her out. I used to live outside of Detroit, and that's how they got rid of. Executives at Ford and General Motors, they just changed the name on the door. That's how you found out.
I can't even imagine the horror coming in the next day and not seeing your name on the door.
Exactly.
I mean, that's scary. That you, one day you just could be all. Now you grew up. You grew up in Pennsylvania somewhere. I am.
We just had a spent 1 year in State College.
In State College, yeah.
Yeah, you're in Pennsylvania, aren't you?
Yes, I'm in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
It's funny, a lot of people have never heard of Westchester, Pennsylvania. I say to them, "You've never heard of Westchester College?" And they say, "No." And it just amazes me, because I thought everybody had heard of Westchester College.
Right.
But apparently they haven't. It's amazing what people don't know nowadays. Where else did you live?
Oh, I lived in East Lansing. I went to grade school in East Lansing. And I was, before that, I was born in New Jersey, Orange, New Jersey, and we lived there until we moved to East Lansing. And then... my father moved to Arlington to go to Episcopal Seminary. So we were in Arlington for 2 years, and then he got a job in Pennsylvania for a year, and I don't know what happened to that job, but he gave it up after a year and went to a church outside of Detroit, Bloomfield Hills, and stayed in that area for about 10 years, although he had moved to different houses. So he And then he left that place and went to several others. I mean, he was I don't know if he was restless or claustrophobic. You know, he would take a job and do a very good job at it. But as soon as he sort of knew how to do it and was doing a good job, he'd want to do something else.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, when you get an idea for a book, like when you first got the idea for Burn Palace, were you excited by it? I mean, what was going through your head? I mean, did you know the whole book? Could you see basically the whole book in your head? I mean, tell me about that.
No, I couldn't. I mean, what I saw with a combination of stories was a potential story, a potential novel. It's not a novel until you know how to tell it, and you have to find the right kind of tone, the right kind of language for it, the right kind of mood for it. And once you have that, then a lot of stuff can unfold fairly easily. But it's always in the telling and in the structure rather than in the story itself. Yeah, how's the story paced? How's the information come out bit by bit to the reader? And we read, obviously, looking ahead. You know, it's a linear, you know, we read sequentially. We wonder what's the next word going to be? What's the next sentence going to be? And that's how surprise and suspense works. Suspense is something, you know, makes us care about something, how something's going to happen in the future. And so if you're working on the book, or I'm working on this book, it was just a way of trying to balance those things so it didn't get too crowded at one point and too sparse at another point. And just to keep that moving, and to keep a series of surprises occurring, and to deal with the frustration and the fear of the people, and then just the frustration of the police.
Right, and you build the tension really well. I like the way you do that. I mean, I love a book that just kind of unfolds little by little by little. And of course, Stephen King's books do that really well, too. We don't always find out things until, you know, in the middle of the book, we'll suddenly find out something about somebody we had no idea was going on. That's what made Agatha Christie so great. I mean, a lot of times you didn't find out about a character truly until the end of the book.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you found out all this stuff that you thought somebody was one way, and they were exactly the opposite. But isn't that true in real life, though, that people are not always what they seem?
Yeah, exactly. We were just talking about that.
Yeah. I mean,
people are putting out their best foot forward and all that. I mean, you go to a singles bar or something like that, you know, you're not going to go there looking angry and dirty and the rest of it. You know, you spruce up and you go out and you try to shine.
Right. We put on our best for everybody else.
Yeah.
Sometimes with our friends we can be ourselves, and we can just be whatever, moody or whatever it takes, whatever we need to get through the day, I guess is what it is. But I wonder, do you have more ideas for fiction novels coming up? I mean, are we going to see more fiction?
Yeah, there's another novel I'm sort of poking around with that'll be set around here, but I'm just barely beginning it and trying to get ideas together.
When you say set around here, what
where I live, I mean, it's going to, it starts out in New London, Connecticut, and then it'll include other parts of Connecticut and then Rhode Island.
So that do you have the whole idea for the book? I don't want you to give me any details. I know you can't really discuss it too much, but I'm always curious about what a writer's working on. Is that, you think that's wrong for a fan to be like that?
No. I mean, I have enough to think that's going to carry me 100 pages or so, and then I have certain ideas of what's going to happen after that. Well, how I do these 100 pages is going to determine how those pages after they're going to think. I mean, writing is a form of thinking, and you reach ideas by writing that you don't reach any other way. And so if you can begin the book and keep things open and you know, keep questions going, keep them up in the air, you know, what's the cause of this, what's the cause of that, then you can keep it up. And you're always dealing with cause and effect. Or you get the effects of something. That snake is basically an effect. Well, what caused it to be there? You know, so they try and seek out that cause.
Who would put a snake in place of a child? You know, that's, what mind would, what sicko would do something like that? Like, You know, you and that's what the reader's thinking all the time. You got to keep the reader thinking all the time. I mean, because when they stop thinking, that means they don't care about the book anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to really work to make them care about it. And some of that, again, the suspense, or I mean, you try to do it on various levels. You try and make them care about the characters. You try and make them care about the story, the unfolding of the story. Make them even care about the humor or the comic elements within the book.
Wait, did you want this book to be more of a thriller or more of a mystery, or what would you classify it as?
I don't classify. Critics classify. Uh-huh. I just write it.
Well, if you had to say, what would you say? Is it too hard for you to say?
I mean, I could say, certainly they call it a thriller, and I suppose it's thrilling, but I think, you know, you use any term, it immediately diminishes it in some way. It's a thriller, but it's also, in many ways, a very serious book.
That's a good point. Yeah, indeed. I never thought of it like that. I always, you know, the bookstore I was working at would have a thriller section and a mystery, and we always wondered why they weren't combined. Because, you know, there's so much stuff that is in a mystery that could be considered a thriller.
I don't really understand the distinction.
I guess thriller, mystery, I mean, the difference between thriller and mystery, I don't think I'll ever understand what the distinction is. I think of Murder, She Wrote. I don't think of Murder, She Wrote books like thrillers. I think of them as mysteries, because there's a murder and you have to solve it. That's a mystery.
Right.
But there's also some thrilling moments. You know, you find the dead body. That's a thrilling moment. I mean, where do you draw the line between one and the other?
Well, I tried to mix them with just some of the outrageousness. You know, finding the snake and then the guy being scalped and then the stories that start building up. You know, it's a mystery that seems to be about to burst into being a thriller at any moment.
And you also have, you know, the townspeople who are beginning to suspect one another, which makes it
exactly.
Even more interesting. I mean, who do we trust anymore? We can't really trust anybody. We don't know what's going on.
Well, that's what I meant about once you start questioning the safety of where you are. Once things come in that you can't explain, then you start questioning the safety, questioning the appearances. You have a sense of what your town looks like and how people behave. All that is appearance, and something happens to jolt that and make you question that appearance. You're immediately insecure, and if it goes on for a while, and you're trying to think, well, who's doing this? Then you look at the people who are slightly strange in the environment. You look at that guy who has to have corn 5 days a week. You're looking for anyone who separates himself or herself from the norm, and that person becomes suspicious, even though it's, you know, the person can be completely innocent.
We always look at people. I mean, I always think to myself, I don't want to be a creature of habit. I want to do the same things every day. I mean, my dad was like that. He'd do the same thing every day at the same exact time. And I always thought to myself, I hate doing that. I want to do something different all the time. I want to always be thinking up new things to do, and I don't want to be predictable. I mean, I don't know about you, but I hate being predictable. I hate when people say, oh, I know exactly what he's going to do or what he's going to say or how he's going to react to that. I mean, there's that predictability, I just think, is boring.
I guess so. I mean, I've never been challenged. I've never been accused of being predictable, and I doubt that I am, really.
No, your Burn Palace is far from predictability. I mean, there's no way you can predict what's going to happen next in this book. That's what makes it so good. And the same thing with Church of Dead Girls. It just blew me away with how really... I still see those chairs in my head. Those chairs are always, for some reason, they just left a permanent mark on me. It's interesting how that happens. I don't know why certain books with the scenes stay in my head and others I forget 2 days after I've read them.
Right.
And, you know, there's so much today with quality rather than quantity. I mean, actually quantity rather than quality. I mean, get as many books out as you can. You know, get your name out there. Get people buying it because they know your name. But to me, if it's not quality, why bother having it come out?
Right. But what the publisher's going to be looking for is something that gives causes without effects. That, I mean, if you're never looking ahead with that question of what is this. So in a romance novel or a quick spy novel or something, what's on the surface is just what's there. There's not much of a question of what's lying ahead or what has caused this.
Right.
And it becomes very superficial.
I mean, I think of the writer P.D. James, who writes that fabulous mystery series with Adam Dalgliesh, and then she writes a book called Children of Men, which is so totally different and which I have no interest in. I like the way she writes. I like that certain style, and I don't want it changed. And that's a lot of what the public likes, too. I mean, they're used to a certain thing from authors.
I expect that's true. That's something that they have difficulty with me, because I've written in different genres
But you enjoy that. You enjoy doing that, though.
Yeah. I hate the idea of repeating myself repeating myself, saying something I've said before. Go on.
But you've never really done that, though, in your career.
Right.
I mean, you've always done something different, always something fresh and new, and that's what I like. I mean, I love that an author challenges himself to do something that he's never done before. And that's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult to not repeat yourself in some way. I mean, it's even some little way, you know,
right.
In the tone of the book and in the characters, you know, having a character seem like another character. You know? I mean, sometimes when you read a book, you can't tell one character from the next. They all seem to be, you know, they all seem to have a similarity to them, or the hero has the similarity to another book that author has written.
Right.
And you don't remember the central character. They just become, it's more of a plot-driven novel than it is a character-driven one. Do you feel that having the characters down is more important than the plot?
There was a English mystery writer, Marjorie Allingham, who said that the books that she wrote a lot of tremendous mysteries, but she said that you read a book for plot, you remember it for character. And that seems to make sense to me.
That does make sense. That's a good quote. I find that with so many, I wouldn't say so many authors, but enough that it annoys me to some extent. Like, I don't really remember the characters. And when I think of Sue Grafton, I remember Kinsey. Kinsey's a very vivid part of my imagination because she's so real to me. The way she writes that character. I mean, but that's not true of every mystery writer. Some I can look at and read and think, I don't know. I don't really like the character. I don't really identify with the character. They're not real enough to me.
Right.
And
those are always disappointing.
And it's a shame, but, you know, I guess some people like that. Some people just want to escape, something to escape to that they're not necessarily going to remember the next day, you know.
Well, some of these little reviews on Amazon for Church of Dead Girls, you know, made that complaint that the book was slow and the characters were too complicated. They just wanted it to move much faster. They wanted the murders to come much faster.
No, it's a great one. There's nothing wrong with that book. I totally take exception to that. Those people, that's for sure.
But it says something about what people's expectations are, and it even says something about their degree of education. You know, they want a very quick fix, the same kind of thing that you'd get on television.
When I remember when I read Church of Dead Girls, I don't think I'd ever read anything by you, so I really had nothing to expect. So maybe that was better that I didn't. And not that anything else you've written was bad or anything. I'm just saying I didn't know what to expect. When I opened the book, I got such a treat because I just really enjoyed the book. And yet I didn't have anything to compare to that you'd written before because I hadn't read anything by you before.
Right. I mean, the book that came out, I guess before that book, is it before or after? The Wrestler's Cruel Study is incredibly different from The Church of Dead Girls. It's not a mystery. Well, it's just a mystery in a way, but I can't even explain it. It's a very peculiar book.
Are you sending a message with each book? Is there some kind of message that you're sending, or is it just...
No, not consciously.
I mean, would you say there's any running themes in your books? Something that tends to appear in every book?
Maybe that idea of safety.
Because I know, you take like an author like John Saul, who always writes about children, always. Every book is about a child. There's always a child in his books, and that seems to be the theme. And I just wondered whether it was something with yours. I haven't noticed anything, but I've only read two of your books, though.
Yeah, no, there's not that I can think of.
It's interesting. I mean, I know I've had authors tell me that there are themes. I can't think of any offhand. I know William Lashner told me one time that every one of his books has a character throwing up in it. which I find very amusing.
That's an odd ambition.
It is. But apparently he did it in one book, and then before he knew it, he was doing it in every book. But, I mean, it's such a weird thing. I mean, it's so different. I mean, who would want to do that? and yet it's something that he did and seems to enjoy doing with every book. You've probably never read William Lashner.
No.
he writes legal, a hard luck lawyer, a lawyer who's not very rich and just tends to have bad things happen to him. But he's they're very humorously written.
Uh-huh.
So, but I mean, and I just love the way he tells the story. He, the one he wrote about the dentist was just amazing. He wrote a book about a villain that was a dentist, and it was just a crazy book, but a very memorable one, though. But it's interesting that he said that, though. I just wondered whether you had anything that was.
No, I mean, I'll put in little things that friends will see that they'll respond to as a kind of joke. I mean, I can put in their names, for instance, but that's just playing around. I mean, there's nothing that there's no kind of theme thing. I think that comes out, except that sense of we try and find safe places for ourselves. The moment we have a safe place, then we stop protecting ourselves. Stop watching. Stop keeping an eye out. And and all those books, I mean, it's true of any mystery, I think. You know, something is interjected that suddenly makes the playing field unsafe.
Do you ever think while you're writing that maybe what you're writing sometimes will reveal too much about yourself?
No.
I mean, I know I've written things to people. Like, I'll write an email to somebody, and they'll come back to me, and they'll say, well, why did you write... And they'll intuit something that I didn't even say in the email, and that kind of freaks me out sometimes when that happens. I just wonder whether you're ever concerned that something might come out. Is it something about your life maybe you don't want people to know, or, I mean, some little thing? Or
no, there are things I don't put in the books, but there's nothing that I'm afraid... I mean, once the book is done, it has... The information it has is it can reveal things about me, but it's not going to reveal anything that really bothers me.
Right.
I mean, it's not going to... I don't have sex with sheep or anything, you know?
Exactly. But I don't know. I don't know why I bring that up, but it kind of hit me that, you know, that people have intuited things from things I've written that I haven't necessarily meant.
And sometimes that happens if a person doesn't write precisely enough.
Yeah.
It certainly happens. I mean, I've seen that in student papers.
Maybe I'm just a bad writer.
Well, I wouldn't jump that far.
I know. But, I mean, that people could see that when I didn't even mean to write that. Maybe it's just that I haven't refined my writing process yet. Maybe I need to work on it. I don't know. But I mean,
maybe it's them.
But you had said before that a writer tends to be biographical or write about things that have happened to him or things that have influenced him or things that he's been through or things he knows.
Right.
I mean, they always say write about what you know.
I don't know what that means. I mean, I know what it means in the sense of write about lives and so on that makes sense to you in some way.
Well, if you know a lot about baseball and you write about baseball, they say, you know, it makes a better book because you know so much about the topic, I guess. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what they mean by that. But
yeah, you would have to know that. I mean, you have to have the background information. One of the things that made this novel easier than other novels that I've written was the internet. I used to have to go out and talk to lots of people and take lots of photographs and things, and I did very little of that with this book because it was all available on the internet.
That's great.
I mean, I can go to the Rhode Island State Police site and get, you know, the yearly report, which would talk about the crimes that they had that during that year and the kind of things, etc., and the breakdown of how the state police in Rhode Island are structured. And there was one state policeman I talked to, but then I, you know, all this other information I got online.
I like the sense in the book of the police, the policeman being baffled, of them not knowing what's going on, of them being fearful about what's going to happen next. I like that, that recurring theme through the book. It makes it so much more interesting. You know, this fact that they don't even know what's going on. They're worried because they've never seen anything like this before. I mean, it's all new to them.
Yeah.
And I like that that's recurring through. We always think of policemen, they always seem to know everything. They have all the answers, you know. They know exactly what you're thinking, and they know what your intent was or whatever. But they don't. The fact is, they don't. Maybe they pretend they do a lot of times.
Well, there are people like Agatha Christie's Poirot or Nero Wolfe's character and others. You know, a writer that I like, a mystery writer, was Simenon, the French writer who wrote all these stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Inspector McGray,
yeah.
And those things are, you know, McGray is trying to find the answers. And every one of those books, even if it's not a good book, has some moment of really, that's psychologically wrenching within it. And Simenon was just brilliant at that, of just getting something that's so psychologically wrenching.
I mean, do you learn something with every book you write?
Yeah.
And what greater thrill is it than that? You can learn things. I mean, it's like watching Jeopardy all the time. You just learn things constantly.
Maybe.
I take things in. How much I remember 10 days later, I don't know. But you do learn things. And that's what I know. Linda Fairstein wrote a book one time about art, and was all about the art forgery world, and it was just fascinating to read about this and learn all about the art stuff. And you know she did the research work. It was too detailed not to be researched. And I find that thrilling, that we can learn that much from one book.
Right.
And it's just so wonderful. Well, we've just about run out of time. It's been great fun to talk to you. I've enjoyed this immensely.
Yes, I'm glad that we're able to do it.
Yeah, me too. You've made my month. Your new book again is called The Burn Palace from Blue Rider Press. I'll make sure everybody knows that Blue Rider Press is in all the bookstores, and I'm sure it's on ebook and all over the internet. So thank you very much. I really appreciate this.
Well, thank you for having me.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.